This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there and check out the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum debates. Today, we are talking with Dr. Deborah So. She's a sexologist and the author of The End of Gender, Debunking the Myths About Sex and Identity in Our Society. We're especially going to talk about why trans rights matter, why science matters, and what the two things have in common and in difference. Deb, thanks for talking to Reason.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for having me back.
All right. Yes, you were on a wonderful podcast over a year ago, I think, along with Christina Hoff Summers, talking about some of the same issues in your book. Let's talk about the book. Give me the elevator pitch for the End of Gender.
So The End of Gender is a science-based approach to, as you mentioned, debunking myths about sex and identity in our society. And I was really inspired to write this book based on all of the questions people have been asking me over the years, ever since I first started writing about the science of gender. And to answer their questions in a standard column, you know, it's usually about 1,000 words. It's not possible to get to all of the issues that I would like to. And also to fight the misinformation that's out there, because I find it really disturbing the fact that so many of these myths are being spread in our society. And people are saying that the quote unquote newest science actually backs them up when that is completely false.
So let's, you know, the book is organized in chapters that take on what you say are different myths about gender and sex and identity. You know, the first myth, and why don't we start there, is that biological sex is a spectrum. This is something that we hear more and more, in not only is biological sex a spectrum, but sexual expression or sexual orientation. All sorts of things. I know I celebrated this. You're more critical of it when Facebook some years ago came out with something along the lines of 50 plus gender identities that you could plug into. Okay, now it's at 71. So it's like better than Baskin Robbins, right, or Pop-Tarts. Why is it wrong to say that biological sex is a spectrum?
Well, number one, because it isn't. And I'll start by saying my understanding in terms of why people say this is they're trying to make room for intersex people, which I think is a good thing. But even for in the case of intersex people, most intersex people want to live within binary sex. So most want to live as either male or female. So I'll start by defining biological sex. Sex is defined by gametes, which are mature reproductive cells. So that's either sperm or eggs. There are no intermediate gametes. So as a result, sex is binary. And from there, we can also, okay. I mean, there's also the argument that gender is supposed to be a spectrum, which it also is not. And I talk about that in the book, because again, gender for 99% of us is the same as our biological sex. And I don't think saying that invalidates intersex or trans people.
Right. And, you know, so you're basically, you reproduce either as a male or a female, or, you know, with sperm or eggs. That doesn't seem to rile people too much. When you talk about intersex, those are people who have what genitalia that is kind of indeterminate,
right,
or they might have elements of both. But they still, if they produce gametes, they produce one or the other.
Exactly.
Right?
Or they're infertile.
Okay. So then I guess we get on to, we get on to a sexier topic, which is not sex, but gender. Gender identity, you make big distinctions between kind of gender expression and gender as an actual fact. Can you talk a little bit about that and why that also is not a spectrum, even though, you know, certainly that's the way most people approach it now?
So gender identity refers to how we feel in relation to our biological sex, so whether we feel more masculine or feminine. And the vast majority of us are gender typical in our gender expression, which gender expression is how we express our gender identity. So whether we, through, say, mannerisms, the way we dress. So with regards to gender being a spectrum, you know, as I mentioned, if gender is for 99% of us the same as biological sex, there's no evidence to suggest that sex is a spectrum. And the other thing is with gender supposedly being a spectrum. So I understand, again, this is with the, I think, goal of people who say this, they're hoping to eradicate gender norms and to say gender stereotypes should not hold people back, which I'm fully in agreement with. I don't think we need to tear down what gender is or the science of gender to do so. And in fact, when you say something like gender is a spectrum and that it changes or that gender is fluid, I think that actually hurts people who are gender atypical, because it suggests, say in the case of someone who's gender dysphoric and they feel more in alignment with the opposite sex, how is that not then an argument to say these people should not be allowed to transition and they should just basically wait until they feel like they're in accordance with their birth sex?
Well, isn't the idea though, I mean, or when you say, you know, most of us are kind of gendered normal, or we represent male and female, you're not talking about a particularly restrictive identity for what is female or feminine, what is male or masculine. I mean, this, you're not talking about, a man is somebody who, you know, grills steaks and has a beard and, saws wood or something like that. And that's the limit of masculinity. Can you define what are the broad kind of parameters of what is male and what is female, the way that you're talking about it?
Well, I guess when we look in terms of in society, it can change a bit among different societies. But I think when you look at men and women as a whole or on average, there are certain traits or interests or behaviors that are associated more so with men, and the same with women. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that there are not some men who are more like women or some women who are more like men, or that there's no overlap. I definitely would agree that we are more alike than different, but it's also not correct to say that, you know, it's basically these traits are completely irrelevant or that they only exist due to socialization or that they're meaningless. And the other thing I would say is just because someone is gender atypical, because this is the newer way of thinking, is to say if someone is gender atypical, they really are the opposite sex. So someone like me who's a gender atypical woman who feels more masculine, I should be a man or I should be a third gender. And that's something I'm very critical of in the book, because I think it's actually harmful, especially for young people, because we are seeing this movement of young women who are identifying either as male or identifying as non-binary. And it's actually doing a disservice to them.
So this, and I mean, one of the things that's fascinating about your work in general and the book in particular is, in a way, I mean, it's very learned, it's very open also. I like, it's both personal and also kind of scientific and rigorous. So it touches a lot of bases on that, on those fronts. But it also, you attempt to be extremely rigorous about your findings. You know, can you talk about what is like a defining attribute of being a woman or being female, and how is that unchanging? Why would it be bad to deny, a woman who doesn't, kind of conform to that?
I think one way in which this conversation has permeated in our society is with regard to occupational interests. And I wrote a column back in 2017 when the Google memo happened and everyone was attacking James Damore. I wrote a column for the Globe and Mail defending him and the research he cited, because in my mind, and I think most non-ideological experts would agree that the scientific studies he cited were accurate. And so
give a quick two-line summary for those of our listeners who don't remember the Damore memo or the Damore memo at Google?
Sure. So as part of diversity training, Google employees were asked to give feedback in terms of how to improve the sex ratio, and because there is a paucity of women in STEM and as employees at Google. And so Damore went and looked at the scientific research and said, maybe this is due to the fact that women on average have different occupational preferences than men. And this is due to biological influences as opposed to socialization and sexism. Just very broadly, of course, not the case for every single individual person. He was very clear to say that he's in favor of diversity and he does not a fan of sexism. I have interviewed James and I don't believe he's a sexist person. So that's essentially what the memo consisted of. And then it was leaked to the public and there was a huge outcry of people saying that it was sexist and misogynistic, and that he was saying that women are inferior to men and not capable in science. And that's not at all what the memo was saying. So going back to your point in terms of why that scene is threatening, because I do understand, and since writing that column, because people were very upset at me, that column, was picked up by a number of places and people were quite upset at me. And I understand, it's been 3 years since then, why people found what I had to say so threatening. Because yes, in the past, people have used that information, the fact that there are on average differences between men and women in terms of inherent interests and going to biology in the brain, how this can be used to hold women back and to say women are not as competent. Women should only be relegated to staying in the home and making babies, and that we're not good at math and things like that. But I think it's important to have a more nuanced conversation to say we can acknowledge that there are on average biological sex differences in the brain. Gender is not a social construct. Mm-hmm. That's not a justification for sexism. That's not to say that one sex is better than the other. And in fact, to hide that information, I think it actually does a disservice to women, because when people do find that this evidence exists, they think that it is justification for their sexist beliefs.
So how, what do you, talk about the ways in which you and other people who do this kind of research can make sure that they're actually, you're actually talking about biology or about a genetic predisposition, as opposed to merely replicating, you know, kind of social construction of gender identity. I mean, women are allowed now to, you know, they're allowed into a lot more professions than they were, say, 30, 50, or certainly 100 years ago. And people back then said, well, you know, women shouldn't even be allowed in these industries because they wouldn't be interested in it anyway, or they would be incapable of doing that. I think back a lot to, I'm a fair bit older than you, and I can remember in high school, when I was in high school, there were no women pole vaulters because it was a kind of scientific fact that everybody just acknowledged that women didn't have the upper body strength to pole vault, so they wouldn't want to do it anyway and they wouldn't be any good at it. That's no longer the case. How do you separate out what is cultural or, you know, what is nurture from what is nature?
Well, if you look, there are a number of different areas of research that support the idea that gender and gender-typical interests are innate. One body of research pertains to girls with a genetic condition called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. These girls are exposed to higher than usual levels of testosterone in the womb. And when they're born, they gravitate toward female-typical toys like doll. They gravitate toward male-typical toys.
Yeah, like dump trucks and stuff.
Yeah, trucks as opposed to female-typical toys like dolls, even though their parents give them more praise for playing for female-typical ones. So that speaks to the fact that there is a really strong biological component that is not influenced by socialization or parents or teachers or caregivers or the media or whatever else.
Is it a better world, though, where girls and, you know, in high school or K through 12 can participate in more sports?
I think so, if that's what they want to do, for sure. I'm all for boys and girls being given full range of opportunities and interests, regardless of whether you as an individual are gender atypical or typical. Mm-hmm. What matters, I think, is having the choice as opposed to having a 50-50 split in terms of representation.
Yeah. Do you, that might be getting a little bit ahead of myself, but without you talk about in the book how at various points you had identified both as a punk rocker, bless your heart, you're wearing black. I appreciate that greatly. But then also, you know, as a feminist or possibly even a radical feminist when you were younger and before you started your PhD studies in research science, is it without the arguments that feminists were making, particularly in the late 60s and early 70s and the kind of first thrush of the women's movement, of the feminist movement in Europe and in North America, would we have seen women getting those, you know, and which was very much predicated upon the idea that there were no inherent, innate, essential differences between men and women, often, and that women should have the same opportunities as men. That was grounded in a kind of belief in social construction of gender identity. Without that, would you have even been in a PhD program?
I would like to think so, because I think a person's inherent, again, interest and ability and your sense of ambition is not predicated on social norms necessarily.
Right. No. But what I'm saying, your PhD is from York University in Canada,
yes,
is that
Toronto.
Right? Yeah. I mean, did they always take women as students? I mean, you know, in America anyway, I mean, many schools were gender segregated. Many of the best schools, many technical schools, scientific schools were, you know, gender segregated until the late 60s or early 70s.
Right. I definitely credit feminists for doing a lot of the heavy lifting for those of us who get these they are privileges today and to be treated fairly and equally, definitely. I've only really distanced myself from the label of feminist in the last couple of years, just because I think the movement has started to stand for things that I'm not on board with and I think have slightly missed the mark. But I'm still definitely in favor of gender equality. And I think also in the process of writing this book, for me, I've been asking myself a lot of questions in terms of, you know, what's important to me. And at the core, I do still support the movement. And if its aims are gender equality, it's when it starts to promote science denial, when it starts to lie to women, especially about who we are and what's important to us in the name of some political agenda. That's what my issue is.
Let's talk a bit more then about, some more of the myths in the book, including myth number four that you take issue with is sexual orientation and gender identity are unrelated. What are you talking about there?
Well, so sexual orientation, you can't say that anymore. You can't say that sexual orientation has any bearing on gender identity. And in the, especially when it comes to gender dysphoria and the question of transitioning, it is important to take into consideration an individual sexual orientation because that does speak to what the outcome could potentially be for that individual. So I can talk a little bit about what's the best way for me to approach this because there are a number of different areas.
Well, so talk about, again, gender identity is the expression of how a person feels about themselves.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes. And sexual orientation relates to whom you're attracted to. So you're heterosexual.
And one of the things you talk about is that both of these things are actually, you argue that they're actually pretty fixed. The kind of contemporary discourses that these things are much more up for grabs and might change over time, or an individual may be may have a sexual orientation or a gender identity of A at the beginning of a week and something very different at the end. And you're saying that, that's all wrong.
Right. Because number one, if you say that sexual orientation is fluid, as some people have begun to do, which is something I never thought anyone would ever say, because this flies in the face of the gay rights movement. The gay rights movement really, sexual orientation is biological, as I say in the book, and it's fixed. So it cannot be changed. And I think regardless of whether sexual orientation is biological or a choice, people should be free to pursue partners, whomever they're interested in, so long as it's consensual. Right. But it is biological. And so the gay rights movement, I think that did help gay people achieve equal rights. And there are a number of studies that have shown, and I cite them, that speak to the fact that if sexual orientation is biological, people are much more accepting of gay people. And I grew up in the gay community, so I've been a huge supporter of gay rights my whole life. So the thing is, if they're saying that sexual orientation now is a choice, which some people do say, then how is that not an argument in favor of conversion therapy, to say that someone who is gay should seek to change that? And I do not support conversion therapy for sexual orientation whatsoever.
The argument there, though, that if it's something that is taught, you wouldn't necessarily force people all to be the same. You would let them choose whatever they want it to be and actually give them, the education or the meaning, the training that would allow them to be sexually oriented towards whatever they want it.
In theory, I'm assuming that's what the justification is, and that it's true liberation if we can choose every aspect of our lives, including sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. But again, my issue is that it's not scientifically accurate, and it's part of this larger movement or ideology to really rip apart every aspect of science or the science of sex. And that, again, I think is really harmful because it really makes it more difficult for us to better understand who we are.
Yeah, and I realize there's, not so much when I read your columns, but when I was reading the book, there was something gnawing at the back of my mind. And it's a small L libertarian, I like the idea that humans are as much as possible the kind of captains of their destiny, and that we can choose to live however we want, and we have a right to do that, and we're innovative, et cetera. And one of the things that I think your book challenges for a libertarian of my ilk, and I think you're very libertarian and very individualistic and laissez-faire yourself, but you know, is the idea that something like sexual identity is not infinitely plastic. It's not something that we can just change whenever we want. How do we know that?
Well, if you look at the research literature, again, it's associated. So similar to gender identity, it's associated with prenatal exposure to hormones or testosterone in the womb. So higher exposure to testosterone is associated with sexual interest in females. So this is the case whether someone is male or female. So you'll see with most men are attracted to higher levels of testosterone and are straight, but for say lesbians, they were likely to be on average exposed to higher levels of testosterone in the womb. And so this also plays into the discussion about gender transitioning in children, which is chapter 5, which I'm sure we're going to get to.
We're building up to that.
But essentially, you know, so my argument in that chapter, all of the research literature suggests that the vast majority of children who are gender dysphoric, so they feel they're more the opposite sex than their birth sex, they are likely to grow up to be gay in adulthood, not transgender. And so that is also another way in which sexual orientation is linked to gender identity. But the way that activists speak about it is as though gender identity is completely separate from sexual orientation. This has no bearing on these children, and hence the justification why they should be transitioning at younger and younger ages.
I want to get to the discussion of both of transgender populations and especially transitioning at a age of minority. but before we do that, to talk about kind of gender or sexual orientation, your book talks a lot about, and it's true, you know, by everything I've seen and certainly the evidence you present in the book, that, you know, the vast overwhelming majority of people are gender typical. Women act kind of recognizably as women, men act recognizably as men. There are groups distributed around that, men are most interested in women. Women most in men, men who are interested in men stay interested in men, women and women and all of that. What do you do with people who are bisexual? How do they fit in? Do they present a conundrum to the schemata that you're bringing forth? Where do they actually exist, I guess, is a way of asking that.
Bisexual people definitely do exist. I would say there's a difference in terms of the etiology for bisexual women and bisexual men. So female sexuality is more flexible. Women are less category specific than men. So women will be aroused, say, when looking at different forms of pornography, whether it's if women are straight, they will show a genital response to lesbian pornography. Whereas men are very category specific with their sexuality. So if they're straight, they're really into women and not men. And if they're gay, they're really into men, but not women. So with bisexuality, with women, I mean, bisexuality is a little bit more common, and there have been studies to show that it's associated with, again, higher levels of exposure to prenatal testosterone.
What are the percentages we're talking about here? Because this is also, depending on how old you are, you would hear, numbers thrown out all the time of, that 10% of the population was homosexual or gay or lesbian. You know, more recent estimates are, that it's in the low single digits. But, what are the general percentages of heterosexual, gay, lesbian, bisexual?
So heterosexual is not about 97%, and then gay and bisexual would be about 3%. But I think it also depends on how people self-define, because some people might may base it on, there's a variety of different parameters in which you could self-label yourself as bisexual. And I talk in the book about how bisexuality now is considered if you feel sexual attraction to both sexes. So it's not even predicated on actually having sexual activity, which to me lowers the bar in terms of who is considered bisexual, which again, I think goes back to this ideology of really trying to say everybody is to some extent not straight, so you can really pick your sexual orientation.
Well, and how does this intersect with a kind of Kinsey scale where, Alfred Kinsey, the early sexologist, would talk about, instead of saying, binary stuff, he kind of introduced the idea of a spectrum or a scale. Does your researcher or do you completely, kind of dispose of that? Or do you say it's kind of true that some people are very heterosexual, some people less so, et cetera?
No, I agree with that. I don't think what I say necessarily conflicts with Kinsey's scale. But I think one thing that we're not talking about, so say bisexuality in men, In the book, I talk about autogynephilia, which we can get into. It's a very, very controversial subject. Also, gynandromorphophilia. So these are paraphilias. And also masochism, which is when people...
Explain what a paraphilia is.
A paraphilia is an unusual sexual preference. So that was actually my research expertise.
In the slang, that's kinks. I mean, that's what you were studying, yeah. Kinks. And you say in the book, by the way, not only is sexual orientation fixed, but the paraphilia is pretty fixed for most people. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the way we conceptualize it in sexology, which is the scientific study of sex and gender, is that paraphilias are akin to a sexual orientation. So they're not the same thing, but they're similar in that they are with someone from very early on in life, probably from birth. It cannot be changed, and it's also going to be their primary sexual preference throughout their life. So when we conceptualize paraphilias this way, you can't change them. So for someone who has, because a lot of the men that I used to see in my research, they felt a lot of shame and embarrassment, and they wanted to change that aspect about themselves. And so I would say, right. You know, as long as it's consensual, again, there's nothing wrong with it. And that's why I really advocate for sex positivity, mm-hmm. because whatever people are into, for the most part, for men anyway, it's not a choice. And I think as long as it's not hurting anybody, then that should mm-hmm. be perfectly acceptable.
So, I mean, the idea of saying a paraphilia is, you know, it's inborn and it is unlikely to be changed through therapy or anything like that. It's, I don't know if you have like a latex fetish or something. As long as you're not hurting anybody or hurting yourself, you can say like, it's okay to be that way.
Right.
I mean, that's essentially the therapeutic insight that you're bringing to this.
Yeah. So the thing is with a paraphilia like masochism, where people find it sexually gratifying to humiliate and hurt their partners, there's a difference between masochistic disorder sadism.
Sadism
is what I'm talking about, not masochism. So sadism is when you find it sexually gratifying to hurt and harm your partner. So there's a difference between people who have sadistic disorder, in which they cannot control these impulses and want to act out on it, versus someone who just is sadistic and doesn't actually behave or act out on it because they know it's non-consensual. So it's a little bit...
Or do it in a ritualized way where it's not actually hurting.
Right. They can incorporate it into their sex life in terms of, say, fantasies, but they don't actually act out on it. So I think sometimes people get upset when I say this because it's difficult to, in some cases, to delineate between sexual fantasy and behavior, but not everyone who has a particular sexual fantasy necessarily acts on it. Especially if they're a law-abiding, pro-social person.
Right. You know, one of the things that, it's running throughout the book, and we'll talk more about it, it's fascinating because the discussions of sexuality, it's so open and positive, and it's like, it's very accepting and tolerant, but it also says that, you know, this stuff isn't going to change. 30 years ago, maybe even less, you would have been being attacked mostly by people on the right for a kind of normalizing perversion. And now it seems like you get more attack from people on the left saying that you're too rigid in your discussion of these things. What has happened in the kind of broad social discussion of sexuality?
I would say science denial coming from the left, and I would still consider myself to be a liberal, just definitely not mm-hmm. an extreme left person. But I would say science denial on the left has become much more of an issue because within sex research, the vast majority of us are liberals. So historically, most of the attacks have been coming from the right. I wouldn't say all right-leaning people have an issue with sex research, but again, historically, most of the contention has been coming from that side of the political aisle. So when it's your own side attacking you, you almost feel, my sense in the field is that people don't feel it's as serious of an issue. It's crept mm-hmm. up on the field, and now it's a huge problem. And I would say it's, as I write in the book, there are many instances in which now left-leaning activists are really destroying the field, and it's really sad to see because I think science denial is just as harmful regardless of what side it's coming from.
Right. Well, let's talk about myth number five then, gender with children with gender dysphoria should transition, because this is really, I think, one of the cases or one of the best instances of where you talk about it from the way you're talking about this stuff, that science denial leads to really bad policy or really bad medical procedures and kind of thought patterns that end up having a really deleterious effect on people. So children with gender dysphoria should transition. This is a myth you debunk. Explain gender dysphoria briefly, and then talk about the current state of the the push to have kids who seem to identify as trans should actually be given hormones or even surgical interventions earlier than you think makes sense.
Right. So as I mentioned earlier, all of the research literature shows that the vast majority of kids with gender dysphoria desist by puberty. So gender dysphoria is the feeling that one's gender is more in alignment with the opposite sex than their birth sex. And desistance is the fact that, again, the vast majority of kids who feel this way no longer feel this way by puberty. But if you look up desistance, it's considered controversial. And I understand why. And I want to emphasize, I do believe that adults should be allowed to transition. Adults have the cognitive capacity to make those kinds of decisions, and it's your body, so that's your business. But for children, they do not. They do not have the mental capacity to make life-altering decisions. And again, if the vast majority are going to outgrow how they feel, it doesn't make sense for them to transition, because it's very likely that they're going to change their mind and then have to detransition.
Could you explain a little bit what's involved both in transitioning and in detransitioning? Because I think one of the more popular arguments that gets bruited about is the idea, well, transitioning, especially if you're not doing a full gender reassignment surgery, it's not that big a deal, so you can detransition. But that's not actually accurate, is it?
No, especially with the kids. So this argument is that a social transition is really harmless. And those who support this path, they will say the child is just taking on a different name, getting a different haircut, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's not a big deal. But that's not the reality of it, because a child is not only taking on the characteristics of the opposite sex, they're also being treated as though they actually are the opposite sex. And so early transitioning is actually associated with persistence. So these kids are more likely to then go on and seek medical interventions. And the thing is, I'm totally on board with letting kids play with whatever toys they want, dressing however they want. If you have a little boy who wants to wear makeup, or a little girl who wants to cut her hair short, I think that should be totally fine. You don't have to treat the child like they are the opposite sex. And I think most good clinicians would agree that there's nothing wrong with that. But so I don't do clinical work anymore, but my colleagues really cannot do their jobs properly. And in fact, in Canada, we have this bill that is going, that's currently seeking to be passed, that actually criminalizes any sort of therapeutic interventions that seek to understand a child's gender identity in this way. Anything that is not affirmation, which is essentially facilitating a transition without question.
And detransitioning, what I think in the book, you there's a stat that says like about 2% of people who have transitioned, adults, have regrets about it. Is that accurate? And then how difficult is it to detransition, if you've had gender reassignment surgery, but also if you've had, hormonal treatments or something that is less kind of physical?
So that study that you mentioned is a Swedish study, and it did find that approximately 2% of people who choose to legally transition and medically transition will detransition, so go back to identifying as their birth sex. But the thing with that study is that the way that they counted people who detransitioned were people who had gone and asked to change their legal sex marker. So not everyone who detransitions goes through that process. And as well, the data were finished being collected in 2011. So that's before this new influx of young people we see, especially young adolescent girls who are identifying as transgender and are seeking medical interventions. So we don't yet know what that's going to look like. We don't yet have those numbers. But in terms of the process of detransitioning, detransitioning is seen as a myth. People, activists will say that detransitioners were never really gender dysphoric, or they were never really transgender. And so, I mean, for someone who is, say, taking testosterone, they will potentially live the rest of their life with facial hair. Their voice will be deepened. I've heard of cases where some young women who've since detransitioned and are now identify as female again, they have permanent changes to their clitoris. So their clitoris is permanently enlarged. And they're saying, how am I going to have sexual partners if my partners are straight men? And there's no information for them. There's no recourse for them. And once we start talking about genital surgery, I mean, that's another thing. That's not reversible.
Right. So, I mean, this is a case where if, again, summarizing your argument, if the science that is being used to discuss treatment procedures and encouraging people and things like that, if that is faulty, people are making choices that they, you know, may later regret, but also not be able to reverse either.
Absolutely. And especially for these parents are not being given all of the information. They're being given a very biased, in my sense, narrative. And many of the parents I've spoken to have been told that if their child does not transition, that child is going to commit suicide. And, you know, that's not true. The statistic that they often cite is not, doesn't have any application to children. And for the people in that study, they had high levels of comorbidity. So understandably, with these parents, if you're told, do you want a happy daughter or a dead son, they're going to say, I'm going to go with having a happy child, whatever that takes. And I really feel for them because I don't think they're fully aware. They're not really making an informed decision because they don't have all the information available to them.
Now, as a good libertarian, I want to reiterate that you are in favor of people transitioning if they want to, if they're adults. At what age would you say people should be allowed to have that kind of, you know, pretty radical autonomy to change their gender?
Well, the current guidelines suggest that when we go, say, through the whole process, so pubertal blockers should not be until puberty, cross-sex hormones should not be until 16 or age of medical consent, which is sometimes lower depending on the state, and then genital surgery or bottom surgery should not be until 18 or age of legal adulthood. But we do see these surgeries happening at younger ages. Double mastectomies, I have heard of cases of young women getting this as young as age 12, and genital surgeries, I've heard of vaginoplasties being done at age 16. So to me, that's way too young, way, way too young.
What, but, you know, as people approach legal adulthood, they obviously, I mean, you know, they should have more right to, you know, do whatever they want.
Right. I agree with you in that way. And I think if clinicians could do their jobs and sit down with a patient who is considering these procedures and do a proper assessment to determine, is this actually going to help you? Are you going to feel better after? Then I would say, okay, even if someone who is 16 decides that's what's right for them, I still feel like that's a bit young, but I would feel more comfortable with that. Yeah. But it's the fact that clinicians really can't do that. They can't ask any questions. So now when someone comes in and they say they want these procedures, they essentially have to facilitate them.
Is, you know, here's a more of a sociological question. Trans people currently, and I can't remember if it was in your book, and if I get it wrong, correct me, or if I read it somewhere else, but the estimate of the trans population is, I've seen, is like around 0.3%.
Six in a thousand now.
Okay, so that's pretty accurate, or that's what gets talked about. You know, that's a vanishingly small number of people, and it doesn't mean that they are not important, but why are we talking about trans issues so much? I mean, it seems for a population which is pretty small numerically and also seems to be, you know, being able to kind of enact whatever policies they want for themselves. I mean, it seems easier to transition than it might have been 30, 40, 50 years ago. Why do you think so much of the conversation that we have in, you know, kind of social media as well as in public policy things? I mean, where is that coming from? Why do we talk about this issue so much?
I think it's because gender has become very trendy in recent years. And I want to emphasize that I do think people with I do think gender dysphoria is real. And I think for people who are struggling with their gender, that's something that should be taken seriously. And we should offer compassion and empathy for those individuals. But I do think that on some level, because gender is so prominent now, and that people get so much attention and praise when they identify as anything other than their birth sex, that's playing into it. And I think it's also people recognize that this is a way for them to get social accolades, to move ahead in their careers, again, to bring more attention to their brand and to their platform. So I think that's part of it. And also because this particular ideology in academia has gone unchallenged, now it really has gone beyond these particular disciplines to spread into the sciences. Now it spreads into the mainstream and it affects people in their everyday life, at work. I mean, it's insane to me. People send me screenshots all the times of things that they encounter in training at work or in their children's education. This was a problem that 5 years ago, people were saying to me, this is not a real issue. This is something in academia. We're never going to deal with this in real life. So, you know, we don't have to worry about it. And
what,
now
what
it's changed.
Kinds of, yeah, what kinds of things are people seeing that that upset you?
With education, say in their kids' education, it says children are being taught that there's no such thing as boys and girls, or that people choose their gender, or that people's gender can change over time, or that gender, again, gender and sexual orientation and anatomy and gender expression all have nothing to do with one another. And it's just not true. And I think it's very smart and calculating of these individuals to target children with this way of thinking, because children do not know any better. And in most cases, the parents don't even know that this is what their kids are being taught in school. And when the parents do realize this and they go to the administration and say, this is not fact-based, you can't be teaching this to the kids, the administration will say, well, the new science shows this. So that was another reason why I wrote this book, because I wanted to offer a resource to parents. This is something that a book that you can potentially give to your kids to help fight that misinformation.
What are the worst policy outcomes? I mean, you know, I think the question of having young kids transition before it's appropriate or before their minds are really made up or could be made up is, you know, is kind of a worst case scenario. But what are the other policy problems that you know, that, like, what are the stakes here in terms of actual lived experience? You write about this in your book, and this was a couple of years ago. There were a couple of states in the United States, North Carolina, I think, got the most press for passing, you know, bathroom laws saying that men and women could only use, or, you know, people could only use the bathroom of their birth sex. You know, and that seemed, I mean, it was a social panic, and it seemed kind of bizarre. But is that the kind of, you know, is that so bad if we end up with policies like that? You know, like, really, who cares about that or dressing rooms and things like that?
Well, with the argument around women's spaces, I can get into that. But I think my main concern.
Yeah,
with,
no, well, do.
With,
do
okay, with yeah. the, but the issue with the kids is that for these children who are transitioning, who are going to change their mind, not only are they going to have to live with potentially irreversible medical procedures, but also in many cases, they do have other mental health conditions that are not being recognized or addressed, things like autism, some cases self-harm. For many of these young women, they have sexual trauma. Many of them also are lesbian. And so because of homophobia, they've decided that they want to identify as men or non-binary.
And yeah, that is one of the most fascinating arguments in your book, I think, that actually that the kind of vogue for early transitioning of gender atypical kids is actually a version of homophobia. Could you talk about that?
Right.
A
and
bit?
I remember the last time I talked to you, you were saying in the last interview, you were saying that in your son's graduating year, there were 3 trans boys, which to me seemed like a lot. But this is just how it is now. There's so many young women who do not want to identify as female. And I think understandably so, because especially when you're at that age, you know, you're developing, you're suddenly being sexualized and you're being objectified. And I think most young women, now that they have the option of not dealing with that as a female and becoming male or another gender and removing your breasts, why wouldn't you? And no one is saying to them, it's really unfortunate that as a young woman, you have to deal with this, but it's not always going to be like that. It's not always going to be terrible like that. And the other thing I've talked about is for some of these young people, they've been exposed to pornography and they think that that's what real life sex is actually going to be like. So they don't want to be dominated by a male partner. They don't want to be treated as you know, nothing but a sexual object.
Yeah.
So
that, if you think, like, you know, the job market prospects are bad for young people, pornography does not paint a world that anybody really wants to enter.
No, and
literally.
And I don't have an issue with porn for adults. Yeah. I mean, I used to write for a very prominent men's magazine that featured nude women. And I think if you're, again, if you're an adult and you know what sex looks like, that's very different from a child that is learning about what sex is going to be. I don't think it's good for development. And again, no one is saying to these young women, especially, that it's totally normal to feel this way and that let's talk about that. Or if you feel different as a woman, it doesn't mean you're not a woman. You can just be a different kind of woman.
Hmm. What about something like you were talking about kind of private spaces for women that, you know, trans women are showing up in, men who transition to being women? You know, discuss your discomfort with that.
So my discomfort depends on the particular context and situation. So there are some contexts, I think, where that something like that, women's spaces should be kept to women who were born women. I think, and there are some contexts in which I don't have an issue if trans women are given access, and I think that's totally fine. So something like prisons, as someone who's worked with sex offenders in the past, both clinically and in a research capacity, I think it's completely inappropriate. Because now if a male sexual offender who has offended against a female victim, upon being arrested, if he decides he wants to identify as female, he will be recorded by the police. This is in the UK. He will be reported as female. And if he is convicted, if he wants to go to a female prison, he will be housed there. To me, that's completely inappropriate because, as anyone who works in forensics knows, sex offenders are not honest people. And I think there probably are some cases, surely, where a sexual offender may experience gender dysphoria. And in that case, that should be looked at. But at this point, I feel like these questions have completely been taken off the table. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand why mental health professionals, I mean, the biggest thing is, again, being able to do a proper assessment. And with offending populations, the biggest concern is risk of reoffending. So being able to determine what is the likelihood that someone is going to sexually reoffend. And that doesn't seem to even be taken into consideration. It's very much about self-identification. So prison, I have a real issue with. Something like bathrooms, I have less of an issue. My issue there is not with trans people using the bathroom of their choice. It's that for women's spaces, again, male sexual offenders who are not transgender can use that as a way to get access to future victims. And even though me personally, as an adult woman, I am fine with trans women using the bathroom of their choice, I don't think it's okay that women and girls are being told that their concerns don't matter. And the reality is, I mean, again, in the UK, they did a study and they showed that 90% of complaints about sexual harassment in swimming pools took place in unisex, were the result of unisex spaces. So you can't say that this is not happening, because all of these concerns are basically being completely brushed aside as irrelevant.
In the book, you write towards the end, and I think it's in the chapter, The End of Academic Freedom, or it might be the penultimate chapter, Sexology and Social Justice Make Good Bedfellows, and that's a myth that you're busting. You say activism has no place in scientific research. Fill that out a little bit, and then talk about how do we get activism out of scientific research?
So the scientific method is created for the purpose of getting as close to the truth as possible. And by doing so, if you design your study properly, you will be removing any confounding variables. And as a scientist, you should be open to whatever it is you find, whether it confirms your beliefs and hypotheses or not, if it's potentially controversial or otherwise. But what we're seeing now is scientific disciplines have been infected with activist thinking, and some scientists will determine ahead of time what the outcome should be of a particular study and will find a way to design the study and implement the methods so that they achieve that end goal. And to me, that is not science. That is, again, activism. That's biased. Yeah. It doesn't help us because it doesn't actually represent what we are seeing in the world.
Could you give a couple of examples? Some of the examples, you know, it's partly because I read your work and partly because they've been in the press, but some of the examples of scientists or researchers basically being denied the ability to finish things or to research certain topics. You know, can you give an example or two about that and about the way that activism, you know, is not simply, peripheral to what's going on in academic research, but is actually really getting centrally involved and kind of warping things?
Any research pertaining to the transgender community is definitely off limits. In terms of, well, nowadays activists will say no one should be doing this research unless you yourself are part of the community. But I would say good sex researchers just won't touch it because they see what's happened to their colleagues. Anyone who has tried to challenge trans orthodoxy has paid a price both in their professional life and in their personal life. So I would say the first real instance of this was my colleague, Michael Bailey at Northwestern University. He wrote a book in 2003 that challenged some aspects of trans dogma. And these activists really went after him and tried to ruin his life. So from that point, and he wrote this book about autogynephilia, which we can also, I mentioned it earlier, so I can talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk about it. And is this his book, The Man Who Would Be Queen?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So talk a little bit about that. If I'm remembering correctly, and I think I am, Reason ran a archly critical review of that book by our longtime contributing editor, Deirdre McCloskey, who, is, I think, on the opposite side of many of the issues that we've been discussing from you. But talk a little bit about what happened to Bailey.
So with autogynephilia, and before I say this, I really want to emphasize, I talk about this in the book. I do not want this information to be used to hold back trans people, and particularly trans women. I don't want it to be used to justify negative stereotypes about trans women. And I also think people with autogynephilia should be allowed to transition if that's what they choose. But it mm-hmm. refers to, it's a paraphilia, and it refers to the fact that for some individuals who were born male and identify as female, the idea of transitioning is sexually arousing to them. So this is something that if you look up autogynephilia, there will be so much pushback in terms of people saying that it doesn't exist, that it's a myth, that it's debunked, or that it's outdated medical research, which is not true because everyone in the field knows it's true. And even clinicians who work with adults with gender dysphoria know it's true, but they will never say it because they're terrified. The reason I wrote about it is because I have had so many people reach out to me over the years asking, saying, I have these feelings. I don't know what they are. What is this? Is there any information? And even since this book has come out, so it's been 2 weeks now, I've had so many people reach out to me saying, thank you for writing about that. Thank you for speaking about this because it helps me understand me, or it helps me understand someone I know or that I love. And before, you know, very few people were talking about this. So with regards to what happened to Mike.
Why is it considered controversial that a person who transitioned, a male to female trans person, would be aroused at the thought of themselves as a woman? Or why is that even controversial?
Because it feeds into negative ideas. Well, the one that people who are, that gender dysphoria isn't real, or that people who are transgender don't really exist, and that it's a quote unquote fetish, I guess. I wouldn't say that. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with that. That also, I think, because sex is stigmatized still. And so a big part of the reason why I am so sex positive is, again, I think if we can talk about things, regardless of whether there's a sexual component to the motivation or not, I don't think that should make a difference. We should be able to talk about it like anything else. And I think it is extremely sex negative to say just because autogynephilia has a sexual component that we have to pretend it doesn't exist and completely basically sanitize this narrative to advocate for equal rights for the community.
Well, I guess two related questions. One is how do you bring non-activists? I think you would agree. I'm a explicit postmodern, so I have more limits, I think, to scientific knowledge, or I believe that there are more limits to scientific knowledge or objective truth than you might. But I think we both agree, you know, that the idea that we can get closer to the truth is important. How do you bring back that kind of impulse or a move to get to as close an objective truth as possible? How do you bring that back into scientific research about sex and related issues?
One thing I would say is I wish that scientific studies were more readily available. The vast majority are held mm-hmm. behind a paywall, so it makes it very difficult for people to access them. So in the book, I do offer all the citations to the studies I talk about, and I offer summaries so that, one, that it's hopefully fun and interesting to read, because I do find a lot of scientific papers are dry and they're full of jargon, so it's difficult for most lay people to understand. And I think also for people, some people, they find science intimidating for whatever reason. I don't think it needs to be. So that would be part of it. And the other part would be just to open up this conversation and say, just because something is controversial doesn't mean it should be hidden. we can acknowledge that these truths exist and just talk about it. Because I think that's a much more productive conversation than to hide information, especially something as basic as how many genders there are. So scientists are not going to waste their time pretending they don't know this and they have to go through and figure this out like we don't already have this information. It's a complete waste of time and resources. And academic scientists especially are already, it's so competitive, it's so difficult to get funding, and it's just beyond me that these are the kinds of things that they now have to think about.
So the other, and this will be our final question, I guess, it seems to me, when we talk about things like sex positivity versus sex negativity, the world is so much more sexually free in an absolutely, a positive right way than it was when I was growing up. People talk more freely about sexual feelings. Gays and lesbians are absolutely accepted. They can, not only can they marry, but they're at the highest levels of every institution, every system that we have. And that's not even remarkable anymore in many ways, which isn't to say there isn't still, various kinds of discrimination. But, we've never been as open and as free in being able to talk about and express our sexuality as now. And yet we seem to be endlessly anxious about all of this. Are you optimistic that, we'll ever get to a point where we can just have an open discussion about sexuality that doesn't freak people out for all sorts of different reasons? Or is there just something inherently anxiety-inducing in talking about sex?
I think in time we will get there. I am optimistic about that. I'm pretty optimistic as a person in general. I just think, again, this misinformation really is only holding us back in terms of reaching that goal eventually. So as I mentioned in the book, I think the pendulum will swing back and forth, and I'm sure at some point we're going to be facing science denial from a different angle in the future. But as it currently stands, these are the concerns I have, and hopefully we can just continue to navigate, whether it is coming from the left or the right or another side, that essentially scientists can do their job and the truth can come out.
Do you have a politics? I realize I'm already stepping on the end because I said this was the last question, but what are your politics or your ideology? Because, and it's partly you're Canadian, so who knows what's
weirdos
going on up there, but it is, you talk about yourself as a liberal. Clearly, you steer clear of certain kinds of what would be considered progressive extremes, or at least ideologically. You're nobody's idea of a conservative. You don't seem to be comfortable calling yourself libertarian. All of these things are fine. But, what is your politics or ideology? That might help people to get a better sense of where you're coming from.
Well, I've always been, I would say, progressive. A few years ago, before the extreme left went totally nuts, I would call myself a social justice, maybe not a social justice activist, but I was definitely in favor of social justice. And being a sex researcher, deciding to pursue sex research and now writing about the science of sex as my vocation, I think is also quite progressive. So I try to look at issues on a case-by-case basis. Many people do think I'm libertarian just because I'm in favor of people living their lives and having minimal interference from others and the government. But I think it's important to just look at each issue. I try to take a science base. Maybe science is my ideology. I mean, science is not perfect. I get that. But that's generally what I try to do. And I try to be open to opposing points of view, too, in that even though a particular issue may be near and dear to me, I feel it's important to be willing to look at the other side and consider evidence in support of the other side, because there is a chance that it needs to be rethought.
Well, it is a fantastic read, The End of Gender, Debunking the Myths About Sex and Identity in Our Society by Dr. Deborah So. Deb, thanks so much for talking.
Thank you so much for having me, Nick.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there and check out our other podcasts, The Reason Roundtable and the SOHO Forum Debates. Thanks for listening.